All right, welcome to the RSPcast Quick Game. I'm Matt Waldman, and Mark Schofield has returned to the show for us to resume another Quick Game. Mark, always a pleasure to do this with you.
Matt, it's a blast to be back with you. It has been a while. You've been busy. You've had some things on your plate over the past couple of weeks with the publication of the RSP, always a fantastic product, always a must read for everybody. And we've both been busy kind of, I guess, living life in April and May and March of 2020, which is an interesting experience to say the least. I know we're going to talk about that a little bit, but it's great to be back. It's great to chat with you. It's great to give the people something to take their minds off of self-quarantining and wearing a mask and shopping with gloves on for at least, you know, the next hour or so.
Absolutely. And congratulations, by the way, for your new gig with Touchdown Wire with Doug Farrar. That's a nice get for you.
Yeah, it's a nice little opportunity. You and I both know Doug really well. One of the really smart people in this industry. I had a chance to work with Doug at Bleacher Report for a couple of years as part of the ill-fated NFL 1000 project, which, you know, Doug and I would often joke, if you look at the roster of people that were part of that, you know, from Doug, myself, Charles McDonald, Derek Clausen, Justice Mosqueda,
Brandon Thorne,
Ethan Young, Duke Mannyweather. I mean, Doug kind of assembled, you know, there are a lot of big, great people doing great work in this industry, but he kind of put together not a murderer's row or anything like that, but a pretty good group of people when you look at
– that's a good team.
What Duke is doing, you know, obviously with OLL Masterminds, what Brandon's doing, Ethan Young is Chip Kelly's right-hand man out at UCLA. Like, that's a pretty good group that Doug put together. So, but yeah, Doug and I have known each other for a while. It's great to do some work with him. What's been fun about that is normally I am so laser-focused on quarterbacks that I've had a chance over the past – like right now, Matt, I'm writing up my top 11 interior offensive linemen. Look at me, Mr. Trenches, right? But it's fun to watch a different position. And what I've noticed is, you know what it's like to watch a quarterback, right? It takes like an hour and a half to get through like a game. It can take forever. Watch an offensive lineman, it's fun because there's something you have to think about on every single play. You can watch like one or two games and have a true feel of who somebody is. You watch one game of a quarterback, two games of quarterback, you're like, I don't know what this guy is. I have no idea yet. I got to watch eight more to figure it out. So it's been
fun. just got to ask, is there a certain Georgia offensive guard on your list at all?
There is a Georgia offensive guard on my list. There's a Georgia offensive tackle. When we get to the tackles, that is certainly going to be on my list. I think my favorite, and I don't want to spoil because I know we're going to talk about like favorite guys that we've had to watch. So I'm not going to mention who I have slotted for that, my favorite non-QB prospect in this class. But Nick Harris, the Washington center, he was fun. What I love about – I'm learning things about interior offensive line play that I didn't know. Like I didn't realize that interior offensive linemen or offensive linemen were using rip moves of their own. I was blown away by this. But like I remember watching a play with Nick Harris to run an outside zone to his left, and he's got a two-eye technique that he's got to reach, and he like rips under his arm to like lock him into place basically. And I'm like, this is brilliant. I feel like a whole new world of the game has like opened up to me. So Nick Harris, Damian Lewis, the LSU guard.
He's been fun
to watch. I was watching some of his game against Auburn, and he like picked up a blitzing linebacker, got him into the turf, and then belly flopped on him. I'm like, this is perfect. Like this is fun. You know, I would never have noticed that if I was so laser focused on what Joe Burrow was doing. So it's been fun. Right.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's the same thing when I do Ross Tucker's show. It's kind of fun to see those guys. I mentioned the Georgia guard because he's a favorite because I enjoyed watching him. He looked like a magnet to the second level when you watch magnets collide.
Yep.
You know, it's just like watching that big boy work up to the second level and just like attach himself to somebody. You're just like, it's kind of awe-inspiring to see that kind of burst out of a big man. So
it is. It is. I mean, these are superheroes. They're super mutants that we're talking about. I mean, when you're scrolling through and like for each of these, I've got to put down like, oh, they're like combine testing numbers. And you see like, you know, Lloyd Cushenberry, for example, the LSU center that's 6'3", 312 and runs a 5.27 40-yard dash. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do that now. And I'm, you know, 5'8", 205 and a former track athlete. But he does it. It's 5.27 seconds. And he's only in the 58th percentile at that position. Like, right. What are we doing out here? Like, really?
Yeah. It's yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, speaking of insane, let's lead this off. What were your thoughts on the DeAndre Hopkins trade?
I mean, absolute insanity, right? Like, just like absolute insanity. I mean, I don't understand how Deshaun, and every time this, the Texans make a move like this, all I really do at this point is I just tweet out a picture, and it's a picture of Deshaun Watson from before when he was drafted, sitting in a Maserati, just like staring at the rear, at the rearview mirror. And that's all I can think of. It's like, what are they doing to this guy? A quarterback that I loved coming out. They're just not doing what you do for your rookie quarterback on a rookie quarterback deal, which is to give him help. They're doing the absolute opposite of that. I mean, you take a talented wide receiver like DeAndre Hopkins, ship him to, and we could talk about the Arizona Cardinals flip side of this in a second, but you ship him to Arizona to take on David Johnson, who is a nice running back, but his contract, I just don't get it. And some have said, they weren't going to be able to sign him. Okay. So maybe you do this deal when you can't sign him. And yeah, you get pennies on the dollar, but it might still be better than taking on the contract you just took on in a running back. Like, I don't get it.
Yeah. And what was the, you know, I just want to know what your thoughts were or what his Bill O'Brien's rep was in New England before he took this job, because it seemed like the conversation that was reportedly that Michael Irvin reported that DeAndre Hopkins had with Bill O'Brien sounded like O'Brien was threatened by DeAndre Hopkins, you know, and in a way that was really in an unhealthy way that he was threatened by him, you know, and like completely insecure and like something befitting like a 19-year-old or really more like a 14-year-old mean girl than it was a, you know, a mature human being as a coach, you know.
And, you know, we're seeing some of these new head coaches off the Belichick coaching tree try to be Bill Belichick without the rings, right? Like, you can have the stance that no one person is bigger than the team, and I'm doing to do what's best for the team. And if it means trading away a player like Richard Seymour or Chandler Jones, you know, rather than giving them a big deal, I'm going to do that because it's what's best for our franchise. But I've also got 4, 5, 6 Super Bowl rings to back it up. It's different if you're Matt Patricia. It's different if you're Bill O'Brien. It's different if you're Charlie Weiss. Like these guys that try to be Bill Belichick without the resume to really back it up. And specifically to O'Brien, I mean, what's his real calling card as a coach? What has he accomplished as a head coach at both the pro and the college level? He made Christian Hackenberg look okay before ruining him. He made the Texans a perennial wild card contender. When you've got one of the premier young talents at the quarterback position, when you have two potentially game-changing wide receivers on the roster for him to throw to, like to sort of underachieve in that way, it doesn't give you the clout to then have this attitude with DeAndre Hopkins to – his credit, Hopkins said all the right things, didn't, you know, pour more gas on that fire that Irvin started. But who are you going to believe, you know, given the track record? Which is why I've been so impressed by Brian Flores, by the way, because here's another member of that Belichick tree who has gone in a completely different direction. Yes, he has his beliefs on roster construction and playing the game the right way and things like that. But if I'm betting on, you know, those Belichick tree coaches right now, I'm betting on Brian Flores and certainly not betting on Bill O'Brien. And Bill O'Brien also thinks he can play general manager as well. Well, you know, allow me to gesture in the vague general direction of what he's done to date in that slot.
Right. And then you look at this, you know, from the, you look at this from the getting David Johnson, the thing that kind of cracks me up about that is, yeah, David Johnson's learned to be, I guess, a decent zone runner, but he's really a gap runner. And they don't run any gap in Houston. I don't remember them doing that at all. And you're going to have him playing shotgun in, out of the backfield. And yes, he can catch the ball out of the backfield. That's great. But are they going to use him well? Is this going to be, you know, is this going to be an offense that is going to be imaginative enough to get the most out of him? I don't know. You know, there's some guys that, you know, Kiki QT's been hurt, so he's kind of underachieved due to that. Will Fuller can't stay healthy. So you have issues with that, and he's a terrific route runner, but you know, he can't stay on the field. So who's going to be the guy? And now you've gotten rid of basically the man who really stirs the drink of that offense. Yep. You know, to, and I just don't know what they're going to do other than draft another receiver, but it's going to be another year or two.
Right. And it's the, yes, this is a very good wide receiver class. And, you know, now when you look at what they could potentially do in this draft class, you look at where the Texans now can make a selection. You know, maybe they have the ability to perhaps package something because they don't have a first round pick, remember, because they got rid of that.
Yep.
And so maybe they could package 40 and 57 to somehow move up into the first round, perhaps, to draft a wide receiver. Well, thinking of it that way, it's like reminded me of a scene from Family Guy, okay? Where Fat Doofus husband, Peter Griffin, is in an office with his wife, Lois, and they've got some slick salesman who's like, look, you know, thank you for coming for our seminar today. We've got a special offer for you. We'll give you a boat, a beautiful, beautiful speedboat, or a mystery box. And Lois is like, we'll take the boat. And Peter's like, no, no, no. A boat's a boat, but a box could be anything. It could be a boat. And it's like, that's what they've done. It's like, you could go get a wide receiver, this mystery wide receiver, or keep the guy you have. It's like, wow, we could package 40 and 57 and get DeAndre Hopkins. Well, you already have
him. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is like... this is the equivalent of Anthony McFarlane running into a hole and seeing an opening and deciding that he's going to wreck a good thing.
Right.
Like that's basically, that's, you know, Anthony McFarlane then is literally he must be cousins of Seth McFarlane, maybe distant cousins, because he literally makes Peter Griffin decisions with open creases. So that's for another topic, another time, but in Arizona, I mean, now they get DeAndre Hopkins. You've got a player who's going to be fantastic as a number one receiver with Kyler Murray, another player who can extend the game, you know, extend plays, but also throw the ball, throws a beautiful deep ball. So you're going to have that matchup. I don't think there's much of a drop off there. Might even be an upgrade. And then in terms of quarterback situation, it might, in 2 to 3 years, we might be looking at it as kind of a, well, he's had two equally good quarterbacks, or maybe even Murray's been a little better, depending on, you know, what we see from the system. Do you, you know, I'm more interested. I think the question I get a lot, because I had Hakeem Butler rated so high, is that, you know, does Hakeem Butler have a chance now to be a part of this offense? And you know, I'll take a shot at it first and I'll say, well, yes, because Larry Fitzgerald isn't going to be around forever. And you look at the rest of this, you look at the rest of the guys, and it's like, you know, the Texas A&M kid, I'm trying to remember his name, the Texas A&M kid who plays in the slot.
Christian Kirk.
Kirk, yeah. You know, Kirk's pretty good.
Yep.
I'm okay with Kirk, but I don't think he's a special player. From what I've seen thus far, he's become kind of a Sterling Shepard type with a little more upside, you know, in terms of his game. We'll see if he can continue to emerge, but after that, I'm not really impressed with what I see with that receiving core. I'm not a big Andy Isabella fan. I know he had one play that was great, and all the analytics school people who are public analytics people were all like, probably like, see, I told you. And then the wave crashed over them once again,
right?
As you know, Dance Fever, you know, went back to the bench. So if he can kind of, you know, realign his routes and get his routes in a way where he's not dancing so much and he can be more efficient, you know, maybe they'll be able to use him more often. But again, there's two slot receivers, both who can play a little bit outside, but do you really trust them to get open against tight man coverage? So I think a guy like Butler has a chance to be a compliment And he can be used in a couple of different spots, and we'll see if he can stay healthy. If he stays healthy, I think he would have had a chance last year to grow into a role based on who was kind of emerging. Cause I didn't see, like, you know, was it Keyshawn Johnson who was there or right. Keelan Doss? I'm trying to remember. It was Keyshawn Johnson. And I was like, he was okay. But again, you know, none of those guys to me have the upside that you're looking for unless you have a really strong second receiver. And I think Christian Kirk could be unlocked if that was the case. Same with maybe Andy Isabella if he keeps working on his game. But I think it comes to down to Butler or a draft pick. You know, so it's going to be fascinating to see what they do in this year's draft.
And the other thing that Butler has going for him, I'll give you some numbers. The number 205 and the number 26%. No other team ran 10 personnel more than Arizona. They ran it on 205 of their snaps, 26%. Nobody even hit double digits. Okay?
Good point.
So you're talking about they're going to have four wide receivers a good chunk of the time. And when you look at, okay, say this year, it's Fitzgerald, Hopkins, and Kirk as 1 through 3, right? There's still a slot for a fourth. And that's this year. Fitzgerald, this is probably the last ride. And so you're looking for that sort of bigger body type. I know Fitzgerald does a lot on the inside, but the guy that can be your ball winner, the guy that can be your sort of contested catch type of guy, there's a room there for Butler to develop into that role. And so, yeah, I think he's going to have a ton of opportunities to sort of carve out a role in this offense, given how much they use four wide receivers.
Yeah, very true. Very true. All right. So let's move on to, you know, we've kind of delved into this topic pretty well. Let's move on to some more kind of quick game type of stuff that we usually do. And let's start off with favorite free agent signings. Who were, you know, 2 to 3 of your favorite free agent signings this year, Mark?
Let's talk about a couple. I loved sort of what Miami did. Kyle Van Noy, I think, was a fantastic acquisition for them. Byron Jones, I think, was a fantastic acquisition for them. I mean, when you think about, you know, and again, to return to the Brian Flores situation, he's trying to build sort of his version of the Patriots defense that he was coaching, right? A lot of pressure stuff, a lot of cover one. Now you've got two lockdown corners in Xavien Howard and Byron Jones. You've got Van Noy, who he knows obviously how to use him, sort of that off-ball yet attacking type linebacker. So I love those two acquisitions. I love when a coach shows us their plan for the future and for their offense, which is why I love the Austin Hooper selection. I loved Cleveland getting him, because I don't think it eliminates David Njoku at all. I think it complements David Njoku. You know, similar to the idea of how teams use personnel. Last year, Minnesota used two tight ends, 12 personnel, 35% of the time, 291 of their snaps. Only the Eagles did it more. So I think you're going to see a lot of outside zone stuff. You're going to see a lot of packages with both Njoku and Hooper on the field. You're going to see a lot of packages with Jarvis Landry and Odell Beckham outside. Baker working off outside zone and Hooper having the chance to cross the middle of the field as he boots with Baker and sitting down and finding spaces in zones. That's how they're going to use him. That's what he was best at in Atlanta. That's how they're going to use him. Because Atlanta, like, he's not great working against man coverage, but he can sit down in zones. If he has some one-on-ones, sometimes he can win those. And he had Julio Jones outside. So he's in a similar situation too. So I liked the Austin Hooper acquisition as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll start off that I agree with Austin Hooper. And I also think that one of the things that Matt Ryan doesn't do very well is actually he doesn't like to throw the ball up on 50-50 routes. He's not a fade route type of a thrower. He doesn't make those trust throws very often. And Austin Hooper's actually very good at that. I think Baker Mayfield's going to be more apt to do so. And with that two tight end offense that you're going to see a lot of 12 personnel out of that, I think that that's a really strong look for him. And he's very good after the catch. He usually makes the first man miss. He's a guy that he's not going to be Travis Kelce out in the open field, but he's going to get you, you know, 15 to 20 yard gains on occasion that you wouldn't expect because he can break the first tackle or make the first man miss. And he does it often. I like the re-signing of Kareem Hunt for Cleveland because in this offense, I mean, now you got Chubb and Hunt together still. And Hunt really screwed up at the end of the season, you know, because he had the traffic charge with where he was driving under the influence. And you could tell that his head was not in a good place during that playoff, thinking about how he pretty much screwed up his chances to be in the Super Bowl, you know? So if he, as long as his head's right, I'm kind of hopeful that the way he played well with Chubb last year and how he was, you know, a type of guy that was willing to be the teammate that he was.
Yep.
If that's for real and he can stay on that level, I'm kind of happy about that. And then the third guy that is more just a personal favorite, and I'm interested to see what type of chance he gets. Well, Joe Brady came to Carolina and he had a quarterback that I would describe as very good moving around the pocket, can throw the ball down the field with loft on it, but doesn't have much of velocity on his arm. But, you know, really smart in terms of being able to make plays in the middle of the field. And it sounds a lot like Teddy Bridgewater, you know, and,
yes, it does.
And Bridgewater's going to get his shot again. And I think that Bridgewater was on the verge of showing something, you know, in Minnesota before he had the horrific injury. And he looked like he was becoming more confident with the type of play that he had, that he was making, types of plays he was making in the middle of the field and reading coverage. And I think he's shown bits of that with the Jets and the New Orleans Saints. I think that this is going to be an offense that could work very well for him. And I'm excited to see him get a shot, even if it's just as an expensive bridge starter and they draft somebody else. Or, you know, but I actually think that this could be a nice fit for him, especially with the receivers he has, because those receivers are middle of the field guys. They're not, you know, Curtis Samuel can go up and win a deep ball. Moore's getting better at going up and winning the ball like that. But really, their game is working across the middle, catching the ball in stride. And Bridgewater's very good at that. So I'm really excited to see him get a true shot with a, you know, especially with a team that has, you know, such a powerhouse in Christian McCaffrey, where there's a lot of things that they can do imaginatively with him. And I'm interested to see if Rule and Brady will be able to work together to make that all happen.
I think so, because let's not forget, you know, Brady's offense is basically Sean Payton's with more RPO stuff mixed in. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that he's pulled from Peyton's playbook because, again, Brady was there in New Orleans. And while he was there, who was he working with as a backup quarterback? Teddy Bridgewater. And so the schematic familiarity is going to be such that Bridgewater can step in and be ready right away. And we can't ignore the fact that there are going to be no OTAs. We're in a strange climate. And so if they draft somebody, it doesn't matter. Like, Bridgewater is going to be head and shoulders above anybody they can bring in because he knows that playbook already. And I think he's in a perfect situation. I think this is the ideal scheme fit for Teddy Bridgewater. You know, when you looked at what he did last year in the five games he started, he was getting the ball out quickly. He was getting the running backs involved. He was throwing a lot of quick game stuff. That's Joe Brady's offense. There's some deep shots mixed in. I think this is perfect for him.
Yeah. And I'll add one last one. And it's Browns heavy, I guess, apparently, because Jack Conklin going to the Browns and being able to get him at tackle, that's really been their weakest point. So I'll lead off with, you know, who I thought my least favorite signings were. And the one that kind of comes to mind is also another Cleveland signing, and that's Case Keenum. And it's not because I don't like Case Keenum. I actually think Case Keenum is a very good bridge quarterback. It just tells me that Baker Mayfield might be one step away from not being a starter anymore in Cleveland if he has another bad start to the season, and that Case Keenum could be a guy that could jump in there and deliver the kind of production that they need. Because, again, he's probably going to have a little bit of offensive familiarity, you know, with what the Vikings did in the past, you know, a couple years ago. I know that that's, you know, that's not the same coach who ran the offense, but you're getting someone who's at least familiar with the play action game, familiar with kind of running what some of the things that Minnesota has done, and someone who was on that staff. So I think there's something there. There's something for him to be able to help in the locker room. But I also really do think it's a signal to say, let's sign somebody if we need to bench Baker Mayfield, because Baker Mayfield hasn't played all that well. So, I mean, that's one that kind of gets me, and I look at and I just think, that's interesting. I think Joe Schobert, you know, I'll stick. I don't know why I don't mean to be sticking with the Browns like this, but it's a lot of Brown stuff. You know, the idea that Joe Schobert got left Cleveland. I thought he's a pretty good, pretty good linebacker there. And now he winds up in Jacksonville. And I think that that's a good signing for Jacksonville, but it's a bad situation to let loose for the Browns in that situation. So I'm kind of not liking that. As someone who doesn't like the Denver Broncos, Jarrell Casey, even 30 years old, him going to Denver, that's really nice. And that doesn't bode well for AFC West teams because, him going to Denver and what he's able to do is, that's going to be helpful with that defensive front that they have. That's another one that's kind of, that's interesting to me. And then another one too for the AFC North, DJ Reader going to Cincinnati. Yeah. He's an excellent player. And for him to go there and be paired up with, another great defensive tackle, and put those two guys together, that's something else. Yeah. If Lawson can get healthy, and stay healthy and they can continue to work with the defensive ends that they have, that's going to be quite a defensive end rotation, and they could be a wrecking crew.
Yeah. No, I think those all make some sense. I mean, my least favorite, I think, is Jimmy Graham. actually, let's construct it this way. Ryan Pace is terrified. Okay. I think we can sort of agree on that. He knows he needs to address the tight end position, but because of other moves that he's made, he might not be able to do that early in the draft. And so he sort of panics in a sense and signs Jimmy Graham, the often injured shell of his former self, Jimmy Graham, to basically the same deal that the Packers gave him 2 years ago. And the Packers are, let me just check my notes here. Let me flip through some things here. I'm flipping through some things to make sure. Yeah, the Packers are the team that just let him walk out of town. And so the idea that you're going to basically give him the same deal is crazy. And then what do? These two things can both be true. Nick Foles is a good fit for their offense. Ryan Pace panicked to acquire him. Like, those things can both be true. Like, they needed somebody that can just run their offense, which is why I was ready to just put Sharpie to paper and say Jake Fromm is going to Chicago, because I was of the belief that Jake Fromm could walk into their offense and run it better right now than Mitchell Trubisky. But they want a different route. They trade for Nick Foles and they give up a fourth round pick. They take on his contract, although they've restructured it. It's like, okay, he could be a better fit, or you could do something else. And so Ryan Pace, did he take out a second mortgage? Is this a, uncut gems kind of situation where he's just going to make something happen because otherwise it's going to end badly with him at the bottom of Lake Michigan? I don't know, but he seems overly stressed right now, and
every time I hear someone say Ryan Pace traded for Nick Foles or they got Nick Foles, I just laugh. I can't help but laugh. Like, it's just like, I can't believe that Jacksonville got out from under that. and that the Bears were the ones to grab him. That just mystified me. And then to add Graham to the mix too is just, yeah, it is. It's like it's a cherry on top of this Sunday that, that Rex Ryan might describe in a certain way, but I won't go there. But it's like, it's just one of those deals where you're just like, wow, this just tells you how insulated, certain NFL guys are. And it's like, to me, Jimmy Graham is like that. It's like your kid's rotten binky that he's like thrown up on 8 million times. Right. And it's like they've washed it and there's holes worn in it. And you've actually tried to cut it in half and then cut it in half again so that like he'd not be wanting to use it. And now he's just sucking on that little piece of patch of what it used to be. Yes. And he's still sucking his thumb because you need to get him to stop sucking his thumb, but it's his binky. And I feel like that Ryan, that Jimmy Graham is like that worn out binky, for Pace. And he's like that panic that you mentioned is absolutely there, for that to be the case. So, Yeah, I am completely with you on that one. The Jason Witten to Oakland one confuses me.
Like
that one, like how do you resolve that? I mean, like, you just had Waller. Are you going to make Waller just make him a true wide receiver because that's really what he is? Maybe. Guess so. But Moreau's not bad. Yeah, you know.
They just like him as a person and just kind of want to hang out with him during training camp. Like, I don't know. I mean,
yeah.
Gruden and Witten are kind of peers, relatively the same age bracket. I mean, maybe the two of them and Mayock can just like play golf, you know, after practice, hang out a bit. I don't know. That one. And what's weird is like, I like some of what Oakland did. Like, I like the Mariota acquisition. I think that makes sense. And the way they structured it, they seem to think he's more the future than Derek Carr. It's going to be easier to get out from Carr's contract than Mariota. So that's going to be interesting. I think the Aguilar signing was interesting. I know he became an internet meme with the drops last year, but he's an ideal fit for what they do offensively. I love Corey Littleton. I think that was a great acquisition for them. It was just kind of like, were they trying to see if we were all paying attention? Like, was this kind of like, hey, let's just throw Jason Witten. It was kind of like that scene from Draft Day when they're just like making the guys throw in that like random special teams or just because they could. Like, it was just
weird. Right. It is weird. And then it's like, every time I think of last year where everyone was talking about how Derek Carr where David Carr was, you know, moving in next door to John Gruden. And I just thought, oh, that's not going to end well.
Yeah.
That's not, they're going to be neighbors. Yeah. That just sounds like a bad deal. Like John Gruden if John Gruden and his quarterbacks was like a marriage, John Gruden is that guy that you basically, if you're his wife, you would probably need him to wear one of those like parole type of like bracelets on his ankle. Yeah. And probably have an investigator follow that person around.
Be on that show. Be on that show, Cheaters, that comes on at like midnight on Sunday night, Monday morning.
Yes,
that's usually my wife. I kid you not, that is our like go to guilty pleasure. Like while the weekend is winding down. Although in this new day and age, I don't know what day it is. It might be a Tuesday or a Friday for all I know. But when we're back in reality, like Cheaters, where you like get these like your private eyes like tracking down these people. Yeah, you're gonna see like the Cheaters with Derek Carr someday and John Gruden.
Exactly. It's nuts how that is. So anyway, I mean, you see that and I'm just like, okay, this is going to be interesting. So enough of free agency. I just want to know, what do you think you've learned this year as an evaluator, but may need a few years to confirm that lesson?
I'll give you my pithy answer and my real answer. My pithy answer is that none of this matters. That absolutely none of this matters. And all the hours that I spend breaking down Joe Burrow and Tua and all these guys, it doesn't matter. What ultimately matters is the fact that these guys are going to be picked by people that may or may not be good at their jobs. And so ultimately, the hours that we sink into the evaluation process won't matter because they're going to be drafted by somebody that doesn't know how to coach a quarterback and they'll be ruined as a result. So that's the pithy answer. The real answer is, and this is something I've written about at the RSP and other places, the idea that, you know, the approach that I had, which is get into their minds and figure out, you know, what is it that they're seeing pre-snap? Are they seeing the pre-snap indicators for zone versus man? Are they reading the rotation of the safeties? That doesn't matter as much as can the guy read leverage and put the ball where it needs to be? Like the guy doesn't need to know whether it's stump or stubby or, you know, vice or funnel or whatever crazy schemes that Coach Vass and others are thinking of to confuse quarterbacks. He needs to know where the nearest defender is and how to put the ball away from that guy.
Yes.
That's it. And if he can do that, he's going to be okay because he can learn the other stuff. Or in the case of Brett Favre, he can still not learn the other stuff, but he can still do that. That's, I think, what I've learned more than anything else. This idea that now that I've been doing this for a while, I can pare down what I need to do. But I used to write so much that my hand would cramp before the ball would be snapped. And then it'd be like, oh, he threw a bubble screen. Oh, well, the 40 minutes I just took to break down the pre-snap phase of the play means nothing. And so now I'm to the point where I'm like, did he read the defense? I don't know, because I didn't read it. He put the ball where it needed to be, period.
Yeah. Yeah. Watching, I was watching Dan Hatman's Scouting Academy videos, the quarantine film studies with Chris Palmer. And he was, and I've gotten through about a half hour of it so far. But it was fun to watch him because it confirmed a lot of that with what Palmer going, well, you know, the defender has this leverage pre-snap. It may be man, it may be zone here, but that's not as important as the leverage of this situation and knowing whether or not, you know, the receiver is going to be in the spot that he needs to be. And he's holding off these guys and, you know, and I look at all that and I think, yeah, that's, it makes a lot of sense, you know, with how that goes. But yeah, you go as an evaluator, you go through that whole routine where you're writing so much. And I think I've written tens of thousands of pages worth of stuff to get to that point to go, yeah, I just need to see the leverage, you know, and see, and that makes the most sense. I think for me this year, what I'm in the past couple years, probably starting with Dalvin Cook, but being confirmed with DeAndre Swift, being confirmed with possibly with DeAndre Swift, with Quintez Cephas, guys I've talked about, is the whole idea that the combine, that you have to look carefully at the player's way of playing, their style of play, and see if it matches up with the exercises of the combine. So, for instance, you know, if you have a back like Dalvin Cook who has that curvy linear movement, but doesn't have like, doesn't drop his weight a whole bunch to make these fancy jump cuts in tight spaces or do anything where he runs a ton of stop start moves, are you really going to judge his three cone drill as a relevant drill for his game? Or even his vertical leap for his game, if his style is nothing like that. It's kind of like, you know, judging a percussionist in an operatic, you know, or in an orchestra doing opera to see whether or not he can do Bernard Purdy type of stuff with, you know, R&B, you know, it's like, no, you don't need to do that, you know? And I think it's the same kind of thing. I look at these players and you finally realize it's like, if the player doesn't drop his weight and come to a complete stop and explode out of cuts, and that's not anything he uses in his game on a regular basis. And in situations where most backs would do that, but they do something else or two to three other things that are just as effective, if not more effective for him, then you just look at that combine time and that metric and just go, doesn't apply.
Right.
You know? And I think that that's a freeing thing because it can really confuse you. It confused me to look at DeAndre Swift and go, he's quicker than fast, but he ran a faster 40 than he did a 20. And then he had a slower three cone drill. And then I'm watching him and going, well, he's very elusive. And then have to look at his game and come to the conclusion, oh yeah, well, he just doesn't play to that style. So what's the, you know, it's not a, you know, don't make a big deal out of it. Don't try and twist yourself in knots trying to justify this. Just let the game speak for itself.
Right. No, I think, yeah, I mean, like we talked about before the combine, like use the combine for what it is, which is part of the process, but it should just, you know, put you back to how was the player best used on the field. Like Tristan Wirfs, you know, people were saying, oh, his bench press numbers weren't great. Okay. Well, if he's going to be pushing an inanimate object away from his chest when he's asked to do pass protection, then okay, maybe you can evaluate the bench press numbers. But there's more to playing tackle in the NFL than what you do with your back on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So let me ask you this, Mark. The NFL begins on time because, hypothetically, if it were to begin on time, why does it begin on time?
Because it has to for my sanity. No, I mean, I think, look, if it begins on time, it's because Dr. Anthony Fauci and others have figured out that there is a way to sort of make sure everybody is tested, that we have an antibody test in place, that we can be sure that in the fall when seasons kick off, we're not going to have a second or a third wave. But even if we do, like some people expect, we will be ready for it. Like, I think that's the only way it begins on time. Like, as we get closer to the draft and as we start thinking about the season beginning on time, it's hard to think that it does. But it could if those things are in place. But again, I'm just a lawyer and a bad one at that. And lawyers, for the most part, like to think that they're doctors. And bad lawyers are even worse at thinking that they're doctors. So you probably shouldn't take medical advice from me. I'll just say that.
Well, see, I know some doctors who think they're brigadier generals and gun instructors. Right. So, but hey, listen, I'm with you. I think it does come down to the testing and whether or not we can determine whether someone's already had the virus and whether they have some immunity to it and whether the tests are going to be available enough that it doesn't, that also from a perception standpoint, that the NFL isn't buying up a bunch of tests that could be used on the general public
right.
in a way where they don't have access to it. So if that can happen, fine. But I'll say the NFL begins on time because I have no idea. Ask me in 2 months. And in 2 months, I might say, I have no idea. Ask me in another month.
Right.
But I will say, just for the pithy answer, it'll be the NFL begins on time because I think everybody who is a sports fan who is missing sports in general really wants it to happen.
Yeah.
And it would be a big morale booster for this country, even if they were playing to empty stadiums.
Yeah.
So, the NFL begins late because why?
Because that's where the science, I think, is going to lead us. You know, right. I mean, we are seeing evidence that the social distancing in states like New York State, in states like Washington and California is having an impact. We are seeing that quote unquote flattening of the curve, but it's not going to be universal. You know, it's going to be on different time frames. And as a result, look, you know, New York State might be in a position where come, say, June, you can have, you know, the Bills could have OTAs, the Jets and the Giants might be able to. But, you know, when you're seeing the progression in terms of not just the confirmed cases, but even just the testing numbers. I mean, I was talking to our mutual pal, Jeff Risden, who's in Michigan. And in a county of 300,000 people, they've had like – this was a couple of days ago, so the numbers have probably changed, but maybe like 600 tests. And so yeah. The testing isn't there in middle America, you know, for us to be ready to say people can go back to work by X date. And so I just think similar to what we were just talking about, the NFL starts on time. They have to make sure the testing is done. Now, maybe it's a situation where, okay, Detroit Lions – you're now having training camp at the University of Buffalo, you know, because we know that now you can start on time doing that. Unless they do something like that, I just don't think we'll be in a position where you can start training camps on time, which is going to lead inevitably to a delay of the season.
Yeah. I'm just going to skip and I'll be the bearer of bad news and be the one to say the NFL is canceled because I just can't imagine 70 plus guys for 3 hours, you know, sweating, snotting, breathing on each yeah. other, you know, and yeah. in close proximity. And the minute that one of them catches COVID-19, that the rest of the league doesn't panic and decide this was a bad idea.
Right. And the other thing to sort of build off of that, not to be, again, the bad lawyer that I am, there's a liability issue here. Like yes. I was having a conversation on radio in awkwardly of all places, Buffalo, like last week. And they brought it up, the fact, and I think that's a good point. You don't want to be the first league to have a reconfirmed case. Like yes. say you're the NFL and you decide, look, we can go and, you know, maybe we'll start late. We'll start our season in October. Okay. No other league has started up. They're waiting to see somebody else go first. The NFL goes first and you have a week of games. And then before the second week of games, suddenly Tom Brady tests positive for COVID-19.
Right.
Like, and maybe Tom Brady is in a position where he could beat it. But what about the locker room attendant? Because we think about the yeah. guys playing the game, but the support structure that's in place to see an NFL game kick off, you know, you might have people in more, you know, high risk populations that are part of that process. And then if you are a situation where, okay, Tom Brady beats it, but you know, a locker room attendant has to go into ICU as a result. that's a liability situation that the leagues don't want.
Imagine that former Cleveland Browns coach whose belly was like a completely different part of his body, who's obese and you may find that jolly and humorous on a certain sophomoric level, but him being in a locker room with that potential. Ooh.
Yeah. And, you know, there's even a deeper liability issue if you think about the college game, which I think we're not seeing a fall season. Like, we might see spring college football next year, but I don't see there's any way we can have a college season, because as much as Mike Gundy and Dabo Swinney might feel about it, if you're a university president, you can't put quote unquote student athletes on the field until there's a vaccine. Like, I just don't think you can do that with, you know, student athletes who aren't professionals. Like, the NFL could decide to go ahead because if you're going to be paying these people millions of dollars to play, like, they'll be willing to take that risk. And, you know, the liability issues are there, but not as severe. You can't put a 20-year-old college athlete on the field and say, all right, go play sports now until there's a vaccine. You just can't do it.
And it's fitting to me that Dabo Swinney would come out in favor of trying to put people at risk, because I just feel like that there's just something about him that I just it's like, oh, they should get paid. Whatever. No, they shouldn't get paid. He's in a different world, I think, you know, of coaches. So it's interesting that he and Gundy were on the same page on that one.
Yeah.
So Tua or Burrow?
Let's take the medical aside from it, okay? Let's take the medical situation with Tua and put it to the side, because we are in that Lions season. People are telling tall tales, like I do at the bar down at Veet's in Mobile. People are telling stories perhaps to see players fall or not. Even if Tua is completely healthy, I still go with Joe Burrow. Like, I don't –
okay.
I see in him what you want to see from a quarterback in today's NFL. It's not to say that, you know, he's a perfect prospect. He's not. But what I see from Tua are instances of him – and people sometimes say that he had the benefit of playing with first-round talent all around him, and so did Joe Burrow. Let's be honest. But Burrow would still do the small little things that I think still matter at the position, whereas Tua would sometimes – what I like to say is assume too much. And I, in the interception video I did for the RSP, I talked about this, where he would see something and wouldn't reconfirm it as much as he needed to after the snap, whereas Burrow still does that. There are times when Tua relies on his athleticism as a crutch. Burrow just has it as an extra club in the bag. And so I think you put that together and just on the field, I think it's Burrow. Then when you do factor in the medical, I think it becomes a bit more clear.
Nice. I like the explanation for that. Now, I disagree,
right?
But I like it because I have them very even. I think for me, it comes down to, and it's funny that I say this, because I always kind of, I'm the first one to usually say it doesn't matter so much, but it comes down to arm talent for me on this, on these guys, because I think that Tua has more arm talent. I think that while he did make plays that were sometimes leaning on his athletic ability as a crutch, I felt like that he'll be able to even do that a little bit more in the NFL than what he did at Alabama. And I think he'll be able to do it in a way that'll have more positive expression. Whereas I think that Burrow is more in danger of being, kind of pass rushed into a corner where he's not going to be able to make some of the throws that defenses are going to force him to make. And I don't think it's going to be a deleterious thing to his career, but I do think if I'm, you know, judging on, do I want two players who I think can be field generals, who I think can be, develop into the strategists that you're looking for and be technically sound passers, while I think Burrow is a better decision maker, a better pocket player, I think that Tua can equalize that a little bit more with his arm talent, because I think that the differences between them as decision makers isn't so, so vast that I think it's going to be that it'll be heavily in favor of Burrow. I think it'll be even enough that, you know, some of the, Burrow reads leverage a little better than Tua, but I don't think that there's advanced areas of leverage that where Tua, I think, struggles a bit but I don't think that there are situations he's going to have to see down in and down out in the NFL on a regular basis. I think that he's going to be able to still be able to move the ball down the field pretty well. So for me, it's just the slightest edge for Tua, but I like both the players a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that Tua has a little bit more to improve upon. So let's go to another guy. Love or Herbert?
I said this in a discussion last night about quarterbacks, and the way I phrased it was, I trust Herbert to screw up less than Love. And so right. That's kind of the pithy way of putting it. You know, earlier when I talked about the idea of what matters at the quarterback position is the ability to sort of just read leverage and throw based off that, I think that's one area where Justin Herbert is very good. You know, I see him with some back shoulder throws. You know, throughout this entire process, there are always throws that sort of stick in my mind that if I'm on a show or a radio hit or whatever, I can just come back to and talk about it. It makes me sound smarter than I actually am. So I'm going to do that right now. And it's actually a play that I talked about on the RSP last year. And it was a back shoulder throw that Herbert made against Cal from 2018 where –
up the seam, right?
It was the left boundary. So they were running a switch concept, and the slot receiver switches to the outside, runs the vertical along the sideline. They play man coverage and don't switch it. So Herbert sees that and knows that this guy has to come over to cover this from the inside. So he throws basically a 40-yard back shoulder throw, right hash mark to left sideline. So it probably carries maybe 55, 60 yards, and he throws it on a rope. And I put my pen down and I say, I don't need to watch anymore. He could do that. That will work. Okay, let me get to the next stupid quarterback I have to watch to get through this list of 35 guys. Like, that's enough for me. And while Love has the talent to do that and does it at times, like, Herbert does it consistently. And people will say, like, you know, there are questions about him from a leadership perspective. There are questions about the offense that he ran. I think we need to stop sort of overthinking the offense these guys are coming from. Can he sort of put the ball where it needs to be when it needs to be there and do it with enough that's going to get defenses on their heels? I think Herbert does that. I think Love needs more work. I still don't trust him with his decision-making. People say, oh, he had the 18 interceptions, but he was much better on 2018. Well, To borrow a term of art from somebody that's still in and around this game, he probably had 18 interceptable passes back in 2018. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, are we really that convinced he's that much better on film than he was last year? I don't know. So for me, it's Herbert.
Yeah, I'm with you on Herbert too. I think of Herbert as a guy that if you build the offense around him and you minimize his issues with dropback footwork, with how he pivots and moves so that he keeps his feet in a way that they need to be, kind of like Carson Wentz. Yeah. I just see Herbert as a Carson Wentz type of quarterback, which is, you know, maybe not between the ears necessarily. We don't know that yet, but definitely in terms of his style of play. And he has the arm talent. He often shows the accuracy that you're looking for. I think that he reads the field well enough in quick situations. And he's a guy that can break tackles, extend plays, and make big plays in a more of a playground fashion. So if you can give him opportunities where he only needs to drop back 1 to 3 steps, get rid of the ball quickly, or give him time to be able to buy time, and then just be able to throw the ball over the head of the defense. It sounds very simplistic, but I think that he does that very well. Whereas with Jordan Love, you know, I've talked about this on the show with Sigmund Bloom, but I'll put it this way again, and I kind of feel bad doing it, but obviously not bad enough, which is if Jordan Love was a sandwich, his talent was a sandwich, he'd be this, you know, his talent would be like this, these beautiful, lean, paper-thin cuts of tasty meat, basically on 2 overly thick, stale pieces of bread with some mold growing on one of them. And you would have to, like, cut down the slices of bread, put some condiments on that meat, and serve it with a banging side for it to be a usable meal. And even then, if you went somewhere where they actually had good food to, like, make the sandwich with, the other sandwich would be more appealing. This one would be like, you know, we got this out of a grocery store that was overrun by the COVID-19 virus, and we had to do the best that we could with it.
So Jordan Love is like the college student union deli.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly it. I don't get Jordan Love. Like, I think that this is – I told this to Dan Hatman when we were on a call, and we were debating him, you know, in a very friendly way about it. And I just said, for me, I get why teams will draft him high. I get that they see that in a couple years, maybe he can develop the mental faculties on the field to really process the game well. But I don't think it's going to happen. And I think there's a bit of arrogance by these NFL teams that were like, we didn't think Deshaun Watson would be much. We didn't think Lamar Jackson would be much. We didn't think Patrick Mahomes would be much. And we still are kind of using this whole rationalization that if they got coached up well and that they wound up with good teams that built around them. And yes, there's some truth to that. There's like a grain of truth. There's a couple of nice size crumbs of truth with that, maybe even tasty crumbs of truth with that. But the fact of the matter is that those guys exhibited the high end skills that made a difference in their games for the NFL. They exhibited all of that in college, and the things that, you know, the teams got out of the way and let them be able to grow by implementing things that did that helped them do what they do best, and rather than making them do things that they did worst. That doesn't mean that they fixed them or made them better at their decision-making. So when I see them go, well, Jordan Love's a first-round pick, I'm going, you arrogant people. You literally think that you just can pick a Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, and Deshaun Watson just out like that, and you're going to be able to build him? And you think that Love is an example of that? Yeah, good luck with right. that. I don't see that. So,
they have such inflated views of their own ability to develop a quarterback that fly in the face of all recorded history at the position. Like,
yeah.
And in this day and age, can you really think that with the CBA restrictions, with the restrictions on OTAs and practice time, and oh, by the way, the fact that we're living through a pandemic, you can coach up a quarterback right now? Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Which is why my ideal dream situation for Jordan Love is Indianapolis. Like, that's like the one place where I could see it working, because he will sit behind Phillip Rivers for a year, perhaps two, and he will be with a head coach in Frank Reich that, as long as he's there, at least has some track record of quarterback development, because he was there as part of the team that developed Carson Wentz and helped him. Other than that, good luck.
Yeah, I want to see Love there too, as long as they keep Chad Kelly. Because I can't wait for that. But if Chad Kelly can keep his way on a roster and he's 2 years in and they're like, okay, no crazy stuff's happened for the past 2 years, I can't wait to see. Yeah. But all right. So what's something that you've seen charted with quarterbacks that you find interesting or of potential value?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of things that I think are interesting. I always like quarterback numbers against pressure or blitz. You know, I think that is determinative of what they're going to face at the next level, and a window into the fact that stuff happens in the NFL. Like, you know, you're not going to have clean pockets to throw to. You're going to be under duress with the fact that, look, the athletes, the defenses, and all that stuff, you're going to be pressured. And so if you can handle that well, I feel confident about your transition. And it's part of the reason why I like Joe Burrow. You look at, you know, they ran a 5-man protection scheme on a overwhelming majority of their plays, which means that he's responsible for that sixth guy, whether it's making a hot read and throw or moving somebody around, somebody with their legs. Like, that's why I feel comfortable at Burrow. So, yeah, I think numbers against the blitz and numbers against pressure, I think, are very helpful.
I like that. So what's one that's charted that you're kind of skeptical of the value?
Well, it's not that I'm skeptical of the value. It's you have to trust the person doing the charting. And that's accuracy numbers, right? You know, it's what's fascinating to me is, You know, there are people like yourself, like Benjamin Solak, like Derek Clausen, like Pro Football Focus, like Sports Info Solutions that all chart accuracy. And you can look at the numbers to an area of the field, and there's, what, six outlets or people that I trust, and they get six different numbers. Like, yes. Because there is a subjective element to it. Like, take, for example, and I was actually having this debate in the Slack channel I have for my Patriots podcast. This idea came up. You have a receiver running a quick post route against single high coverage on third and eight. And the quarterback puts the throw low and it's caught for a first down. Some people might say that's an inaccurate throw. I think you would say that's an absolutely accurate throw with pinpoint precision, because if he puts it where he leads his receiver, that it looks pretty, you're looking at a punt and your receiver might be dead. Yes. So you put the throw low by design. I trust that you, and I think for the most part, the individuals I'd mentioned, such as Derek Clausen and Benjamin Solak, would view that as an accurate throw. I don't know the people that are doing it at the bigger outlets, like a Sports Info Solutions. While I know some people there, like a Bryce Rossler, I don't know everybody there. At Pro Football Focus, while I know like the newly hired Seth Kalina and others, I don't know everybody that's doing that charting. So I don't know. And right. So I think if you can trust the people that are giving you this data when it comes to accuracy, you can be confident in it, which is why I go with your numbers and, you know, the other individuals. But I would take your accuracy numbers over the other outlets.
It's interesting because that's a tough thing when I look at accuracy stuff, because I'll see the same thing and I'll see some guys who I respect their stuff, but I'm like, I need to know more. Right. Like, I need to know more of the context behind what they're looking at. Cause like even a play, like I think of a play like Anthony Gordon that I showed this week at the RSP, which was him making a throw where it was in the end zone and he had to throw it over a defender who was trailing, but he knew that defender was going to cut it off. So he had to throw it high and make the receiver go up for the ball. And to me, that was the only place where he could throw that ball. Right. Like it had, to me, that was a pinpoint accurate pass, even though the receiver had to work for it. So it, you know, it's things like that that are interesting. So let's skip ahead, because I've been wanting to ask you about this. I, you know, obviously you told me when I first came out with the RSP, you were like, I'm stunned that you have Jake Fromm ranked third overall. So, you know, we talked about that a little bit. And one of the things that I mentioned was that, you know, I was charting Fromm and I kept seeing throws that looked like there was, you know, I'm not saying Jake Fromm has a hidden gem of an arm that's going to unlock and be Jacob Eason. Okay. I'm, you know, he doesn't have Jacob Eason's arm. He'll never have Jacob Eason's arm, but I do think that he can have Kirk Cousins or Drew Brees' arm. And I think that some of that I think is on display and it can build on it. Like I see throws obviously to the sideline, especially opposite field that are weaker throws, but I feel like when I was watching some of his tape, that there were throws that were late, but the velocity seemed like it was there. But when you watch throws that are late, you usually think lack of velocity. But so it was kind of confusing me. And I started looking at other people's work about Fromm, and I was looking for like anything about velocity. And, you know, I came across Chris Sims' interview with him at Roto World, and Chris Sims talked about him and, you know, and said that, you know, the one thing I can trust Chris Sims about for sure that I know about is that he has caught a lot of quarterbacks from the time he was a little kid to the time that he was in the NFL. And so if he says, you know, Jake Fromm has a stronger arm than I anticipated from what I heard, you actually have a pretty strong arm. You know, that was an interesting note. And they asked him about what he needs to improve. And Fromm's like, I've been an all arm thrower all my life as a, you know, a baseball player. I learned how to do a lot of that. And I have a thick upper body. So I'm having to stretch out my body to get a more whip like motion. And I'm starting to learn that I have to follow the altar of Drew Brees and like develop my lower body and figure out how to do that so that I can, because I won't be able to get away with me being all arm anymore. And that came to, you know, that came to light this year. So obviously, you know, I like the self-awareness. I like the fact that he's working on it. And I think that if he's really been all arm for a lot, in a lot of respects, there's some room for improvement there. But I've seen some, you know, the distance part doesn't bother me about his game, but the velocity was interesting because I saw some moments of velocity that I felt like didn't portray him as like, I know you've mentioned him as a Cody Kessler or Cody Kessler plus, and I'm kind of like, I'm not there. Like, I feel like he's got a stronger arm than that, but it was hard to kind of tell. So one of the things I did is I checked out for the first time JT O'Sullivan, the former NFL quarterback doing QB school, and he did one on Fromm. And he talked about James Coley's scheme and how James Coley was implementing five-step drops for routes that the NFL usually uses three-step drops. And it kind of clicked to me as like, okay, that could be why some of the throws I've seen with Fromm that looked like it had velocity showed up late. And that also if when they show up late, and that's kind of a telltale sign that they're lacking velocity, why we all kind of look at him and say, he's got a noodle arm. Whereas I would say, you know, it's not quite that bad. I think it's actually, you know, maybe that made his arm look worse than it actually is in a lot of situations. And I just wondered what you think about that idea of the mismatched drop lengths to the throws on the perimeter where, you know, they're asking him to run a curl or run the comeback or run an out. And he's, you know, he's delivering the ball two steps later than what they would require in the NFL against guys like LSU's corners playing tight end coverage. Yeah. Wouldn't that be an explanation?
I certainly think it would be. And, you know, after your RSP came out, you know, one of the things that, you know, people brought to my attention with respect to Fromm was this idea. People were asking me, have you seen this? And I honestly, I'll admit, it was something that I hadn't taken note of. But I did go back after being told that and reading, you know, how you sort of were feeling about Jake Fromm. It did sort of click for me, too. I mean, you watch okay. some of their route concepts. You do see him using more, you know, whether it's a three-step gun drop or even a five-step gun drop, which at that point, if you're taking five steps from the gun, you know, you're right. 12 yards behind the line of scrimmage. Like, you turn a 10-yard curl route into a 22-yard curl route. I think most quarterbacks, except for the Eason's and the Herberts and the Mahomes's of the world, that certainly changes how you approach that throw. And I do think yeah. that there is an element of this on film. As to why Georgia would do that, I don't know. Like, somebody smarter than me is going to have to answer that question. But I think it's a valid area of, I don't want to say concern, but it's something that I think people need to keep in mind with Fromm. His curl routes and his other route concepts of his are artificially deeper than they are for the Burrows of the world. I still think that – I don't think anybody is going to say, even with this, that Jake Fromm has an elite arm.
No,
but I do think it's NFL sufficient. And I think that's the threshold. And, you know, the idea that he's Cody Kessler plus, I don't think Kessler came, you know, I don't know if Kessler checked that arm strength box. I think for me, Fromm does. And this is more evidence of why he does.
Yeah. And that's I appreciate hearing that because it's like, I wondered, I'm looking at it, it made sense to me, but I hadn't really talked about it with anybody else because I wanted to put that out on the RSP first and it clicked for me enough that I felt strong enough doing it. But it's nice to kind of get that validation from you because he, you know, to me, I kept watching and going, something just didn't make any sense. And when O'Sullivan kind of brought that up, I just thought, wow, that makes total sense. Maybe Brian Kemp is like, actually James Cole is actually James Coley in disguise. I don't know. I hate to get political, but you know, I live here in Georgia and when you're 7 miles away from the CD frickin' C and you can't, and you didn't know that this virus is asymptomatic, you know, asymptomatically it can spread and you didn't know that. And you're quoted in Newsweek as saying that, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. That's just like, wow. So maybe there's,
it's a head scratcher.
You know, obviously James, it's a head scratcher. So on a very much minor light, not a life changing scale, you know, James Coley kind of gave us a little bit of a head scratcher as well with how they did that. So who's your favorite non-quarterback prospect in this class?
I was in Matt, we were talking about it beforehand. You mentioned, and we mentioned it again at the beginning. The fact that I'm doing non-quarterback stuff has been so much fun because I'm watching prospects and players that, you know, I probably wouldn't have paid that much attention to, you know, because let's face it, I'm a man, I'm 43, I'm lazy. I'm going to just do what I need to do to get by. But now I can't do that. So I've got to actually watch other positions. Did you know, Matt, there are two offensive guards on a play? I didn't know that. obviously, look, I'm getting punchy here, but still. I think my favorite non-quarterback that I've seen so far, I'll give two players. Justin Jefferson from LSU is right. one. I love
me too.
Justin Jefferson. I'm not going to dive into it. I'll let you talk about him more. I just love this kid. I absolutely love him. But I'm going to go defense. I'm going to go interior defensive line. I'm going to talk about Ross Blacklock from TCU. Okay.
Huh.
Interior defensive lineman, you know, shaded nose tackle, two tech kind of guy. And what I love about him is I think Bill Belichick will adore him for this reason, because he just wants to do his job and eat up double teams at the point of attack and let everybody else grab the headlines. To the point where I saw a play where I think it was Texas was running outside zone to their left, so Blacklock's right. And he engages the center, who's obviously flown to the outside, and he sees the left guard start to flow to the second level, and he says, "No, you're not." And he reaches out and grabs him and just says, "No, you're not getting to the second level. I'm going to make sure that both the center and the left guard have to deal with me." And what happens? The linebacker stretches it out from the inside out and chops it down for a minimal gain. And when I saw that big left hand come out of the screen and grab that right shoulder of the left guard, I said, look, get me this kid, okay? He might have three tackles a game. He might never get a sack. But our defense is going to be better because he's willing and sometimes seeking out double teams, whereas other guys in this class, they get doubled, they throw a fit, they're fighting through it, they're trying to disengage. He will just say, nope, double me until the cows come home. We're going to be a better defense as a result.
Yeah, I like it. I like it a lot. Yeah, Jefferson, I'm right there with you. I mean, Jefferson, to me, not only what he did last year, which is what's so appealing about him, I think, on the surface, is that, you know, he's a terrific slot player who can run the option routes extremely well. He's very, how would I best put it? Let me get this real and say, I would just say that he's a guy who does just excellent work in terms of option routes, in terms of being able to, be able to work with quarterbacks off script. He's excellent at being able to create space that way, but he's also skilled at, he's also skilled at being able to work to the outside. Like, he's a guy that even like 2 years ago watching him, he's competent at the very least being able to work as a flanker or even occasionally as a split end.
Yep.
I think he wins the ball very well at the boundary. He can take the contact. He's skilled after the catch. He has that great peripheral awareness to be able to make the first man miss or make pursuit miss that's, you know, coming out from an odd angle. And so I really love that. I love his blocking ability. He's an excellent blocker, but it's that skill off script. That skill, I was joking around yesterday. He's like that guy that there's some receivers that look like they have to, like, you know, how did I say it? It's kind of like they have to, do a mathematical formula in their head when they square up the defense after their route doesn't break open. And then they have to make it, they have to do an algorithm to decide which direction they're going to go. And then they have to call their brother on the lifeline to see whether or not they confirm they made the right decision.
Right.
Whereas with like Jefferson, it's like one move, he's free of the defender and he's in the open space. Like, he just has that feel. So I love him. And I'll add another guy, Justin Matabuike, Texas A&M. The defensive tackle. I'm a big fan of his. I watched him like in September and was like, I kind of put the pen down moment. Like, I was like, you can't fool this guy on long developing plays or misdirection. He will eat you alive. He needs to be double teamed consistently. He's quick. He's strong. He's got good hand movement, smart player who can, and versatile, who can play, you know, I think about three or four different positions along the defensive line based on where you need him to be. But he's probably ideally is probably like a three tech or, you know, in that level. But he's a really, really strong player. And I think that he's going to be the type of guy that if people are asking about, you know, I like the kid Derek Brown an awful lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, a guy who might be more versatile than Derek Brown and could give you, you know, a lot of versatility definitely would be Justin Matabuike.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a question of value. Like, Derek Brown might be a top 10 pick. You might get Matabuike at the top of the second round, you know? And to return to Jefferson for a second, you know, I wrote a piece over at Touchdown Wire about why he's not just a slot receiver. And so, like I'm sure you did, I went back and I watched 2018. And is he going to be in a tremendous split? I mean, that's not his best role. His best role, I do think, is inside or from a tight split as a Z, but he can do it. And while I was watching that, I was watching his game against Miami when he was just putting people on their back as a blocker. And him and Denzel Mims, I think, were my two favorite blocking receivers because they were willing to do it and they liked doing it. And I'll throw in T. Higgins, but with Higgins, it's different. What I liked about Higgins when the ball wasn't coming his way was that he would sometimes block. He would sometimes run a route. I saw him on a touchdown run from Trevor Lawrence in the red zone, pretend he was running a fade, including leaping for the football. And I just thought that was such a smart approach because if he knows he's not going to be part of the play, but he sets you up with how he's going to run a slant route or something, I loved seeing that. And so, like those three guys I enjoyed watching when they weren't part of the play because I loved their approach.
Yeah, that absolutely. Absolutely. I'll add Juwan Jennings is a guy that's fun to watch block. Yeah, he's fun too. But at this point, we probably have a few more left on the table. We left some yards on the field here. So we're going to I think we'll revisit some of the questions we have for the next week that we do this. I have an appointment that I have to get to. Otherwise, I think we'd do this all afternoon.
Seriously.
But, yeah, man. But I hope, you know, obviously on behalf of Mark and I, we hope you guys stay safe. Please take the necessary precautions. It'll be worthwhile not only for you, but for everybody else out there that you're doing that as a service to other people. So please do, you know, please make sure that you wear a mask and gloves and find a way. You know, there's lots of things available out there for you to figure out what's worthwhile. I would just recommend to you is my sister-in-law, who's a nurse, mentioned, you know, showed us a video. It's like, if you can find something that's very thick cotton, tightly woven cotton type of fabric that you fold over three times, put over your nose and mouth, and you can rubber band it around your head, you can test that out by trying to breathe into, say, like a candle and see if you can blow out the candle. And if the air just grazes the top of the candle and just makes it waver, you're good to go. If you can blow out the candle with what you have over your face, you need to find something else. That's kind of a good test just to kind of do that from what's been told to us. So, you know, stay safe out there. You can follow Mark Schofield at Mark Schofield, me at Matt Waldman on Twitter. And, you know, we look forward to getting in touch with you guys again soon for another fun conversation of the not so quick game.